Morning and welcome to the latest episodes of the Moorcrofts Means Business podcast. For those of you who don't know by now, Moorcrofts are a niche law firm based in the Thames Valley, and we specialise in advising clients on corporate, commercial and technology, commercial property and employment law. My name's Matt Jenkin and I'm the employment partner at Moorcrofts. And in this episode, we're going to be looking at a really topical issue, which a number of my clients have talked to me about, I know, which is flexible working and just how flexible do employers need to be? To talk about that topic, I'm delighted to be joined by Catherine Watkins. Catherine is the head of HR consultancy at Insurance HR Solutions. And I like the tagline on Catherine's LinkedIn profile because she helps companies join up the dots and helps to reach a point of clarity on their HR strategy, which I know from the frequent discussions I've had with Catherine that lots of clients need assistance with. So welcome, Catherine.
Thank you, Matt. And I'm delighted to join you and your listeners today. And as you say, on a very topical subject of the whole flexible working and your comment, as you say, of how flexible clients need to be. It's such a sort of a divided view, I think, amongst professionals, but I'm sure we'll get into that as we go through.
So, Catherine, to start with, are you seeing, like me, an increase in requests for flexible working as employers reopen up their offices and start requiring employees to return?
We're seeing less of a sideward step to actually requesting flexible working, but we're really seeing a step change in people's understanding around flexible working. And they're starting to do the big old Google searches of what it means, can they take advantage, how does it differ in their contracts, et cetera. And that's opening up a lot more conversations with our clients and their workforce. And that's where they're coming to me and my team to say, well, what do I need to do? Because there's flexible working as part of their contract. You know, you can work in one poultry lane or at any other office. But then there's flexible working to say, well, you know, I want to do 3 days a week instead of 5 days a week. And that's kind of the subtle change we're seeing is the understanding of employees is around what it means. But yes, there are more bits of paper flying around. There are more assessments being done. There are more challenging conversations that a lot of our clients in the insurance sector predominantly are having to enter into at the moment.
I think that reflects a lot what I'm seeing for my clients as well, which is certainly as employers are saying to their employees, come back to the office. Some employees are saying, no, thank you. I'd quite like to keep the home working arrangements that we've got in place or some part of those home working arrangements in place. So I'm certainly seeing, like you, I'm probably we'll come on to discuss formal versus informal requests, but it's certainly, I think you're right, forming part of that conversation. What are you seeing in terms of employees' expectations in respect of flexible working? I'm just thinking it seems to be a candidate-driven market at the moment. Is that something that employees who are looking at moving jobs are looking for straight away these days?
Yeah, pre-pandemic, there's always been spikes in the recruitment market, you know, year on year. One year can be very flat, the other year it can be a real candidate-driven market. And we're certainly seeing now that we're starting to come out of the lockdown situation that the recruitment market is being led predominantly by candidates. And with that, we are noticing a real change in people saying, well, actually, I don't want to apply for a job if they don't have that flexibility around where I can work. And they're almost becoming more challenging to employers and future employers to say, well, prove why I can't do this job from home because I have been for the last 18 months. And that's taken a real change. So we are seeing that uptick. I think companies are having to be very careful how they assess taking new people on and insisting that they work in an office, the justification that they're giving around it. We write a lot of scripts for our leaders in our clients to give them guidance on how they can justify it. There's definitely been a change in the city when I go and walk around the city from some of the sandwich bars, et cetera, all closing down because I think a lot of them were built off the fat of the land pre-pandemic and now it's kind of coming back to a more leveled out situation. But there's less of that buzz and the train times are different. There's not that peak rush on the trains anymore. So you are seeing that gradual change to, well, actually, I'm happy to come in Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday, but then I want to work from home Thursday, Friday. And they're being picky when they are looking to move. You only have to look at job boards that they now say, you know, flexible working will be considered or flexible location is given, which is a big positive for people wanting to attract talent.
Yeah. And again, I think that mirrors a lot of the situations which clients of mine are coming across, which is candidates being willing to have a conversation and be a lot more upfront over what their expectations are. And certainly this certainly seems to be a pushback from a lot of candidates on 5 days in the office type roles. I think we're seeing more and more candidates, whereas perhaps they've waited to settle into a role for a period of time before they looked at what options were available, and now effectively rejecting roles if there isn't some element of flexibility.
And I would guide listeners to make sure that they consider not just new hires who are new into that industry, you know, haven't got such a girth of experience behind them, but also seasoned people coming in, that you can't actually beat that face-to-face interaction with colleagues. And whilst I have a few clients who are very happy for people to work remotely, they don't need them to come back into the office, which is, you know, great for their circumstances. There are a lot of clients that say, actually, we want that collaboration. We actually want to be sat round a table or a desk with staff. You know, those valuable coffee shop conversations for new people coming into the industry, graduates or 2 or 3 years experience behind them. You can't beat learning that way. But it is that flexibility, that's it's the adaptation to how can we make these people feel included into the business? How can we give them the experience that we've gained over our career, but then also manage the client expectations as well? If you look at accountancy and within your sector as well, Matt, you've got your associates who are going out to client sites. They're doing audits, they're doing assessments, they have to be sat in those client offices because they've got bundles of paper to go through. Those kind of instances, it's almost a prerequisite of the job that you would expect them to be in an office handling all that, you know, client data. But it is that swings and roundabouts. You've got to be careful. Don't alienate, but then adapt your ways of working, adapt how you're training these people.
Yeah, I think it's a good point that you make. And I know I've talked on this podcast before about my views that on the death of the office being overblown, because I think certainly when we're looking at flexible working requests, what I'm seeing at the moment isn't necessarily someone, a few exceptions, but a lot of people aren't necessarily saying, I want to be working from home completely. What they want is some flexibility in this hybrid working model of some time in the office and some time at home. And I think how employers react to that is going to be really interesting. But I think you're right. I think employers, and no doubt we'll come on to talk about this, is how to deal with requests, are going to face some challenges in terms of justifying a return to the office where people have been working at home for 18 months. I think collaboration is going to be the big issue. In terms of flexible working, have you seen the government's proposals on changing flexible working requests, which came out, and some of the things that they're proposing to do to make it more accessible, apparently?
Yeah, I have. And I tend to read them, reread them again. I don't realistically know how they're going to be able to bring it in the format that they are discussing at the moment, making it a day one right for people. Whether the government will go down the route of saying, well, companies need to use their common sense, as they were predicting for a lot of people during the whole pandemic and lockdowns, you know, they wanted the British people to use their common sense, and they established not many people had common sense. But I think they are proposing a solution that fits to the changing ways of working that the pandemic has brought along. And I'm pleased. Our legal system probably does need updating. We do need to move with the times. They need to look internationally at how this works globally in other countries where they do have that flexibility and how those companies still manage to survive and run very well. So it's nice to see the UK getting up to speed. Whether there's going to be much definitive impact of this, I don't think we'll see it for a good couple of years. Any changes to our legal system, as you know, Matt, doesn't happen overnight. It can take a considerable amount of time once all the white papers have gone through, government and everything have been signed, sealed and delivered. But I think this is a really good opportunity for clients now to start being ahead of that curve, starting to think, start planning for their forecast of how they're going to be bringing people in for new hires, changing your contracts for other people. You could be taking on similar roles to ones that are already in-house and taking new people on. You can't treat the people differently. If you've got a new hire coming in, you say from day one, it's your right to work from wherever you want or work from home 2 days a week, and you've got exactly the same role in the office, and you're saying to that person, you've got to be in 5 days a week, yeah, you're going to be entering into some tricky conversations.
Yeah, I agree. I think the proposals, for my mind, are kind of tinkering around the edges. I think they'll probably improve the process for making flexible working request applications, but I don't think ultimately they will have the major impact that perhaps it was hoped for. And I think making it a day one right rather than a 6 month qualification period, okay. I think actually candidates will want to have the discussions before they start work, before that day one actually commences. And I think ultimately, Catherine, for my mind, it's really interesting in reading the consultation paper that the government was clearly looking at making flexible working a default right, i.e. a right to work flexibly. But I think whilst that sounds great on paper, I think what they realised quite quickly was the practicalities of that. And as you've said, some roles just can't be work from home. You know, it just won't work with some roles. So I think that was firmly rejected. And what's very clear is this will still be a right to request flexible working. Mm. And as you say, it's then it's perhaps not so much changing the law on the right to request flexible working. It's perhaps changing attitudes from employers on what they consider when dealing with a request.
Mm. I spend a lot of time with my clients, and I'm sure you do, of how we can interpret the law and the guidance that best fits the company and their culture and their mission and their values. And I think this could be one of those instances. Yeah. There could be a definitive set by law to say this is what you have to offer at what periods of engagement. But actually, clients should be thinking around, okay, how can I make this fit? Or how do I need to change my business to make it fit? You're looking at good press and bad press. You know, you don't want to alienate a talent pool by being quite obstinate and saying, well, no, we've done it this way. We're going to continue doing it that way. You want to attract, you want to retain good talent as well. So it's looking at the flexibility. What do I need to change? How can I get the best out of it? How can I stay on the right side of the law without giving myself headache? And we spend a lot of our time with our clients training their managers, because when you're putting in those flexible working requests, we were having those discussions, you should be going to your line manager predominantly first, started off. And some managers find those face-to-face conversations very difficult. They don't like confrontation, as they would see it. They don't like having that direct conversation. So training people up who are going to be facing off to those discussions will be a really good starting point and sets the culture for the business of how you manage these changes. And I think ultimately you get a more respect from the industry, your peers, your competitors, but also from your workforce by taking a methodical approach, empowering the people internally to adapt to the policies and principles.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that you make about training for line managers, because often this can be quite a difficult conversation, particularly if you're not going to agree, you don't think you can fully agree to the flexibility that they're seeking. So I think there is work that can be done in terms of training staff to deal with requests. How are you advising your clients on considering a request about the kind of level of detail that they need to go into if they're going to turn down a request? So for example, an employee says, well, I want to work 5 days a week at home. And the employer, you know, understandably says, well, no, that's not going to work for us. How much detail should clients go into terms of explaining that decision?
I suppose with your law background, you'd be saying, you know, you've got to have all the evidence, you've got to, you know, be fully equipped before you go into the court to defend your actions. And principally, I would say the same to my clients. For those that like a format of an actual procedure to follow, I create decision trees for them, yes or no, and then that filters down to the next part in the tree, and that filters down to another answer below that, much as some companies will have done with the IR35 assessments for staff. So decision tree matrices are good. Process flow maps are quite useful because you get to sort of see, well, if I go left, what happens? If I go right, what happens? I get them to be as methodical as they can, but then with our HR background, we act as their independent counsel, and in a non-confrontational way, we challenge some of their theories, some of the way that they're saying, well, no, he just can't do that. Well, why can't he do that? You know, show me the evidence where he can't do that, because it's easier for them to get those difficult things out of the way talking to HR than actually doing it in front of the employees. So we do advise clients still to the current day to say, look at your processes, look at your justification, make sure you've got the evidence around why you're saying no to it. And also then be confident around your justification for saying no, but always be prepared that, you know, your employee could, their father or their mother or their other half could be the senior employment lawyer at one of the Magic Circle law firms. So just be prepared that there could be curveballs that come around the corner. But as long as you've got your evidence, so long as you're ethical and you're showing integrity when you're dealing with the request, you're less likely to be criticised should it become particularly a sticky wicket to play with.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with that wholeheartedly. I think it is about evidence. I think we've seen very recently some cases whereby I think there was some decision making made by employers where they just didn't give any real detail as to why flexible working couldn't take place. It's not so much we see within the context of the flexible working regulations, because frankly, I think it's difficult for an employee to challenge under the regulations if an employee says no, to right to request, as I say, not a default right. But where we are seeing it more and more is indirect discrimination claims. And there's been some very recent cases on the childcare disparity. And recent one I saw in the employment tribunal whereby flexible working request, an employee was requesting to move, instead of finishing at 6 o'clock at night, she wanted to finish at 5 o'clock. And that was rejected. And ultimately, they were on the receiving end of an indirect discrimination claim, which they lost. And I think the compensation was £180,000. So, and the reason for that was, as you were saying, is that they just kind of trotted out some, you know, very bland statements as to why they couldn't agree to it. But I think no one had probably really challenged them over it and said, well, actually, what does that mean? Where's your evidence?
No, and whether they come to the likes of your team or they come to my team, have those discussions with the experts first before you then go into the discussions with the employee, because it just, it, you know, it's that practice, it's rehearsing it. This will be a very sensitive subject for some people. A lot of people have got used to working remotely. Some people like having Amazon deliveries and their wine deliveries turning up at whatever time during the day. To now not be able to do that is a big change for them. But ultimately, you're trying to run a business, you're wanting to service clients, you're wanting to make sure you have the right people on. That tribunal case, you say, is a good one, because there are still elements of discrimination that some companies won't naturally think of, or they think they have thought of it all. Yeah. But speaking to you and me, you know, we can explain, actually, no, there could be that one that they're going to be covered by. So planning is essential.
Yeah, and in that case in question, they were in a state agency, and it may well be that actually one of their peak times is between 5 and 6, where their clients have stopped work and are contacting their estate agent for an update. So it may well have been that they needed some level of cover during that time, but they just weren't really very good at explaining the reasons behind it. It looked a little bit to me like quite a lazy decision-making process. And I like the idea that you're suggesting of some kind of decision tree matrix where it actually almost forces an employer to give it proper consideration, but ultimately have the confidence then if they're saying, no, we can't agree to this, it's very clear as to the reasons why.
Yeah, I think I've always worked across regulatory areas, and be it accountancy, law, finance, you always look at the evidence, you look at the steps and the processes that you went through. So that's why I always guide my clients. Let's put something down in paper, think it through. We can scribble, we can scrawl, we can tear them up, we can throw them away, we can file them. But you will end up probably coming back to look at it at some stage, because that is your justification. And that example you gave, that tribunal case, it was a costly mistake for them. So no one wants that, especially at these periods, let alone bad press, because you're citing it on this podcast today. That'll have been, you know, listed in the legal papers as well. So they've got the bad press that no one really wants.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think in terms of process, for me, sometimes I think clients, when someone makes a formal flexible working request, it's probably, I think, sometimes slightly easier to do so because they force you, it's forced down a particular process. But I'm finding a lot of employees at the moment making informal requests. And that's not surprising, because to make a formal request, it's pretty torturous sometimes. But presumably, even with informal requests, Catherine, you'd still say, look, try and get some process around how you deal with it.
Yes. And in the absence of being able to get a process in place, at least engage with your HR team to have a second person to sort of carry you, work with you on that. You're right, there are a lot of more informal arrangements. And I think for me, we're seeing in the insurance sector that we provide a lot of support to at the moment, it's a very old boy network in that sense. And they do, you know, they're down by Lloyd's, they're having a pint over lunch and they have that informal discussion. And they say, yeah, no worries, you can work from home whenever you want. That they consider as a gentleman's agreement. They've shaken the hand on, and I'm sitting there thinking, oh Christ, I can think of all the legal problems that are going to attach to that. So I very quickly go back to those people and say, what was said? I make a file note. I get the person to make a file note. You know, even if that's on the back of a post-it note, you stick it on a piece of paper and, you know, you've got something written down. But then making sure that you're not, as a manager, agreeing to that formal request, that you're not making those decisions in isolation. Talk to somebody else, be it someone above you, be it your HR team, that you're saying, well, actually, this is what I've done. What do you think? Get someone else's counsel. And then you're going to have to go down some route of putting something in writing, because this is now entering into legal territory and almost unprecedented legal territory as a result of the pandemic, that you've got to justify your steps around these things, because you're playing with people's lives. I always think in that respect, you're changing the dynamics of how they've been working and how they've created their new style of living. So the informal request advice, get something down, even if it's a file note, even if it's three or four different file notes. Say, I said to so-and-so on X date, this is the arrangement, this is what they said in return, because it gives the likes of you and me, Matt, at least something to play with if it needs to go into more technical, detailed conversation with the employee. Plus, you can also reference it then when you're doing the letters to confirm the arrangement, which you should be doing. You should have a formal letter to accompany the employment contract to say, previous to our discussions and next date, we are happy to approve your flexible working request for 3 days in the office, two from home. This works alongside your contract, or, you know, very loose letters around that.
Yeah, no, that's good advice. And just also wanted to just to ask you about trial periods as well, because I think, from my perspective, I think a trial period can work really well when organisations are looking at moving to different working arrangements. And that, are you seeing employers prepared to put kind of trial periods in place?
Yes, I guess if we're looking at flexible working requests as a result of the pandemic, we've almost been on a trial period for 18 months. Yeah, so you could say, do I need one? I've been doing it for that long. But then, yes, we, as part of regular flexible working requests, I always say to clients, put in a period. The biggest change I've seen is the reduced time of that trial period that the clients want to put in. So previously, it would be anything from 3 to 6 months in my experience. Now they're saying, well, let's just run it on a month basis. And I go back and I say, well, what's that going to tell you? You know, if anything, at least do a minimum of 3 months as a trial period. If it's all working hunky-dory, the first month, you could, if you really want to, reduce that and say, look, we're going to close the period early. But I would say there's no harm in letting it run. Anything less than 3 months doesn't really work. You're running into bank holidays. If someone is a part-timer, that's going to end in complications around how you actually equate that time. And I just think it's the fairer assessment route around it to make sure that it does fit for both parties. Because then you can try it, you can see what the commute is in for people. If there are spikes in work, and that should also be covered over a three-month period, you know, for people, you know, in the accountancy sector, when they're doing tax returns, et cetera, there'll be busier periods of the month. For payroll people, there's busier period of the month than others. So 3 months is a minimum trial period. I think they are still incredibly useful. They are very valid, but I wouldn't make them too long and I wouldn't make them too short.
Yeah, I think, again, I'd echo that. One of the things I would also say to, you know, looking at trial periods is make sure you're keeping a note of positives and the negatives that occur during that period. Because I think sometimes if you get to the end of that period and you're going to say to an employee, well, actually, it hasn't worked, and therefore we need to revert back to the previous arrangements, you're going to have to have some really good evidence for that. And be prepared to discuss it throughout the trial period as well. Don't think it has to come to them as a surprise. So if there's issues, you can raise them and talk about them.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Matt. I would definitely encourage people to make sure that you put a diary reminder in. Put a diary reminder in if you're going to an appointment or a client meeting. Put one in for each month period review of that trial period, and actually then set up a 15-minute meeting with the individual to say, okay, let me have a quick look. What have you done over the last month? It comes back to that file note concept I say, even if it's on the back of a fag packet, just write down what's gone well over that period. It comes back then to my original comment of that's your evidence. You're building it up. It doesn't need to be in depth. It's not like having an objectives review, because you're not setting objectives for that 3 month period. You're seeing whether everything's working smoothly. So a short file note, a diary reminder that you do it. A, you stay on the right side of the law. B, you stay on the right side of your HR team, because we don't have to come and batter you to get all that information. And C, it also shows the employee that you're taking it seriously. You're investing in their well-being, as it were. You're adhering to your obligations as an employer, and you're collaboratively working with the employee to make sure it's suitable for both parties.
Yeah, I think that bit about diarising and making sure those reviews take place is crucial. It's a little bit like a probationary period, isn't it? Mm-hmm. That make sure you actually have a review at the end of that to sign off on the arrangements or not. Particularly if you want to make sure your HR team are happy with what you're doing, you know, make sure you follow that process. Katyn, that was a really great insight, and I think some really great practical tips in how employers can deal with flexible working requests, and hopefully those listening have got some practical points out there. And I'll put Katyn's contact details in the episode notes as well, so people can follow up with Katyn. So Katyn, just remain to say thank you so much for coming on. I'm sure it's a topic that we're going to be talking about for a long time, because I think this is a really developing area of employment law at the moment.
It is, and thank you very much for the opportunity today, Matt, and I hope the listeners found it useful and look forward to joining you again soon.
Thank you.